Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist and historian Winston Groom, whose new book is The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, and the Unlikely Alliance That Won World War II. We'll also hear about U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith's visit to Louisiana this week, as well as some poetry from James Nolan, whose new book is Nasty Water, Collected New Orleans Poems. It's a great pleasure to welcome Winston Groom to The Reading Life, a distinguished American novelist, perhaps best known for his 1986 novel Forrest Gump, which became an Oscar-winning film in 1994. Winston Groom has also had a prolific career as an historian, and that's what we'll be talking about today. His new book is The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, and the Unlikely Alliance That Won World War II. He's speaking to us today from his home in Point Clear, Alabama. Winston Groom, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me on.
I so enjoyed this book because I love character-driven histories. Now, these are three of the most fascinating characters in history, and you went into this project with a vast store of knowledge already. But there must have been some things that surprised you along the way. Did you learn anything about them that you weren't expecting to?
Yeah, sure. That's the reason I do these things. I'm not a trained historian, meaning I don't have a doctoral degree in it, and I haven't been teaching it for 40 years. Well, I pick subjects. I usually pick subjects that I'm not terribly familiar with. Of course, I'm familiar with them, but not intimately familiar with them. And so I think that also I bring a sort of a novelist eye to it.
Right.
And I see things that, well, let's say a trained historian might choose to pass over. For instance, Roosevelt went to a private Episcopal boys' school when he was a young man. It's called Groton, and it's in Massachusetts, where the preferred punishment for misbehavior was, guess what? Waterboarding. They waterboarded him for 40 years there. And I thought that was sort of interesting. It's a huge thing. But there are all sorts of things. I didn't realize that Joseph Stalin was studying for the priesthood when he suddenly was expelled from divinity school at the age of 16, and he became a bank robber and a extortionist and a murderer and so forth. He was basically a fundraiser for the socialist, the Bolshevik Party, the Communist Party, Lenin's Party. And he raised funds through these means. And then he was exiled to Siberia, according to his story, about eight times. But I think that three maybe can be documented. But he managed to escape, and because Stalin had his own history of himself, and anybody who deviated from that history did so at the peril of their own life. But what is known is that the first escape was he took money sent to him by his mother and caught a sleigh into the nearest town and got on the Trans-Siberian Express and went back to where he was. And he was caught a second time, and he was put into exile in Siberia. But They divided you. They didn't exile you in Siberia the way Stalin later exiled people, which would be they didn't ever come out.
Right, right.
The Tsar actually gave you a pension of some sort where you could pay rent and have food and buy clothing and so on. They just wanted to get you out of the way. They had two houses up in the little village where he was exiled. One was for political prisoners and one was for criminals. And he was in the political prisoner's house, and he was expelled because when it came his turn to do the dishes, he simply put them on the floor and let the dogs lick them clean. And he was sent to the criminal house, which he said he preferred. He thought the criminals were more honest than the political criminals. All sorts of little things like that that you learn.
The more I read about Churchill, the more fascinated I become by him, particularly in his life as a reader and a writer. I was fascinated by your description of his career as a war correspondent. and how important that was for his later life.
Well, yes, it propelled him from the relative obscurity of being a subaltern or a lieutenant in the cavalry to being one of the most famous personages in England, because his family was quite well known. But he began to write, actually, in his first combat assignment, which was in basically what is now Afghanistan, fighting the great-grandfathers of the same people we're fighting over there today. He wrote newspaper stories about it, and he became the highest-paid war correspondent in the world, really. Mm-hmm. And it then got him elected to Parliament, where he had, of course, his enormously successful political career. And so, yeah, and his writing all through his life, he wrote. He wrote books about practically everything. When he wasn't doing something else, he was writing.
Mm-hmm.
And it allowed him, it actually made him a great deal of money, a lot more money than he made in politics. It made him quite wealthy.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit for me about the differences between the conduct of war then and now. With these three, as you're reading this book, you see that so much mattered in terms of their personal relationships, how much correspondence mattered. They relied on letters they had written to each other, and what great efforts they made at that time for face-to-face meetings, which at that time seemed so risky to me, and yet probably made, don't you think, for greater trust, because those journeys were made at such personal risk.
Truth is that none of them really trusted the others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, very
well,
strange.
True, yeah.
I mean, Roosevelt didn't trust Churchill because he hated empires, and of course, Great Britain had the greatest empire on the face of the earth. And Churchill was concerned that Roosevelt wasn't fully committed to the war, and Stalin didn't trust anybody, including himself, so he said. And so it's very difficult to get these meetings established because Stalin didn't like to fly.
Right. Always a problem.
Always a problem. And that was about the only way that Roosevelt and Churchill had had conferences, face-to-face conferences before, but it never was Stalin. And Stalin always made up an excuse like he had to be with his men at the front, when in fact he was never within 100 miles of the front. I didn't like that either. But they finally got together in Tehran, Iran, where Roosevelt and Churchill flew in dodging German fighters, and Stalin came in an armored train from Moscow, and they finally got together. And they did have a fairly convivial relationship between the three of them. It was most unlikely, but they did. And there were some bumps along the way. But in something as large as this, there's very little better than having a face-to-face sit-down where you get to know the other person. Stalin had previously been rather a pain. I mean, he mm-hmm. insisted on, demanded American supplies, and we're giving him enormous amounts of what we call lend-lease supplies, or tanks and planes and guns, and funneling them over there at great risk because they had to be shipped on the ocean where the German submarines would sink the ships. And Stalin complained that Great Britain was stealing the material and on like that. But he could do so because he was fighting the Germans. So Roosevelt and Churchill basically put up with his complaining, and somehow they all muddled through. But Churchill, in particular, never trusted Stalin after the war, what his intentions were after the war. And indeed, Churchill was correct. Stalin, when they would ask him what was going to go on after the war, what was Russia going to stay in these countries it had occupied, Stalin said, we will get to that later.
Right.
And all in good time, and had indicated that no, they wouldn't. And in fact, yes, they did. And that was a great tragedy for 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, one consistent word that people use to describe your books is to say that they're exciting. And we already know the outcome of this story. So what is it like for you? Is that like the novelist's skill at work, embracing the historian's eye for detail?
I don't know. Somehow I think that because I am not overly familiar with the material, I haven't been teaching it for 40 years, I'm able to bring something new and fresh to it. And that's the only explanation I can come up with as to why I think there's a certain liveliness. I don't know. And I hate pushing my own stuff like that, but somehow I think if it's new to me, I feel like I can make it new to the reader. To the reader. It's fun to do. I like it. I like because I'm learning as I go along.
Well, it's definitely fun to read. We've been talking with novelist and historian Winston Groom, whose new book is The Allies, Roosevelt, Churchill, Stalin, and the Unlikely Alliance that Won World War II. You can meet him Tuesday, December 11th at the Louisiana Memorial Pavilion of the National World War II Museum. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. Winston Groom, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
James Nolan has written poetry, fiction, essays, is a well-known translator and longtime teacher here in New Orleans. His last book was a memoir, Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, one of the great titles. And today we'll be talking about his poetry collection, Nasty Water, Collected New Orleans Poems. James Nolan, welcome back to The Reading Life.
It's good to be back here. And I just wanted to mention that my new book, which is Collected New Orleans Poems, is a kind of companion piece to Flight Risk.
Yes, they're very related.
They go over some of the same material, but in lyric form rather than in narrative form.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write in your preface that you'd read the title poem so often that you worried you'd become known as James Nasty Water Nolan.
That's right. You know, there used to be a really jumping poetry performance scene in mm-hmm. downtown New Orleans. And so I was performing at clubs like Cafe Brazil, which is
yes.
now shuttered, Dragon's Den, Funky Butt, Palm Court, Gold Mine. And I always read that poem, and it seemed to get the best response.
So is a poem, your poem was the greatest hits before it was. I think that's wonderful.
It is. What I've been doing with these past two books is I'm quilting.
Ah, interesting.
I'm quilting, yeah. I have all these previously published and anthologized pieces about my life and about New Orleans, and I didn't realize how well they fit together until I started quilting them, the pieces, and they do form patterns and they do form narratives.
Right.
So that's basically what these past two books have been. They've been quilts.
Mm-hmm. That's a lovely way to think of it. So let's hear Nasty Water. Let's hear this famous poem.
Okay, I want to begin by saying that, of course, it's raining today, so it's a perfect day for Nasty Water. Is that New Orleans is supposedly, I refer to the Scorpio, which is an astrological sign, and New Orleans is supposedly ruled by Scorpio, along with Amsterdam, of course, mm-hmm. and Tangiers, and that Scorpio is a sign of a fixed water, which is stagnant water.
Ah.
And I think we share a lot with Tangiers and Amsterdam in terms of our, let's put it this way, a shady reputation,
mm-hmm.
sort of sinister, sexy kind of feel to it. Basically, this is a kind of a scorpionic paean to New Orleans. And in this, it's dedicated to my good friend Joanna Cotté, a painter from the French Quarter who I've known since I was 17. When I was in high school, she was one of the older bohemians I hung out with.
Uh-huh.
She was probably like 25 or something, 26.
And you were a young bohemian.
When I was a wannabe. You know, I was in high school taking the streetcar down to the French Quarter in my sandals. Joanna is married to Jules Cotté, and he's a Quebecois. And so it begins with Joanna complains that Jules tossed out the slimy water with the dead roses in it she was saving to paint a formal portrait of death, une nature morte. She can dry more white roses, but where is she going to get another vase of that nasty water? Joanna, let's haunt the cemetery a week after Easter to scoop up green scum from the lilies rotting in their marble urns. Better yet, we could hide behind the tombs waiting for a fresh burial. Tie a string to a mason jar, then drop it down the well into that murky crawfish contagion of our ancestors' bones. Let's go fill a go-cup with the gelatinous holy water from St. Rose de Lima on Bayou Road. Or next time it rains, drain ditch gumbo from the neutral ground on St. Claude Avenue. Or skim that brackish wading pool in City Park over by the flying horses, the one with those bronze angels peeing on each other, where I pranced and splashed feverish in my underpants every summer while Fat Nana fanned herself with the Dixie Roto under the shade of live oaks. We can't miss the monkey pond at the Audubon Park Zoo, putrid with peanut shells, doodle bugs, and baboon bottoms, or the porticoed seal pool where dead mackerel are tossed at high noon in the middle of August to seal pups too plump to roll over, or the ducks. We can always go feed the ducks near the solemn stone lions at the City Park Lagoon and siphon off some black tadpole broth where swans preen in mean perfection and stale bread crusts bob, bloat, and sink among mosquito hawks. Nasty water? You say you want nasty water? New Orleans is a shimmering mirage floating on nasty water, irrigated by nasty water seeping out of every pore, steeping in crabgrass on the levee like a bitter green tea, then trickling in rivulets down to that queen of nasty water, the Mississippi, Gaia of primordial funk, mother of us all. We drink her, brew her, cook her up into okra gumbo, into a lifelong scorpionic soup of afterbirths and extreme unctions, secretions and family secrets. Nasty water. Nasty water. Proud to call it home.
This poem is so New Orleans. It's just everything. It's the decay, it's the beauty, it's the yuck, the water. I mean,
well, you know,
but it's also the need to make art in the face of death all around.
Exactly. She's doing a natumor, a formal portrait of death, but she needs nasty water. And it's interesting, I wrote this poem before Katrina, and during Katrina, I realized that in New Orleans, water is the reality and land the illusion.
I love that.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious, when you wrote this before Katrina, did you know you had written something really good? I mean, when you finished it, did you kind of sit back and go, oh, yeah, that's one of my best?
It's hard to say for a writer. You never know. I think, like wine, poems some age well and some don't.
This one really did.
And I think this one has proved in some ways prophetic. I think I wrote it around 1997 when I first moved home to New Orleans and really could see the place clearly for what it was. And it was mixed ambivalence, nostalgia, longing. It was first published as a broadside by Dave Brinks when he was starting the press.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And Dave and I were really putting together the little downtown poetry scene at that point.
The Gold Mine, yeah.
The Gold Mine, the Cafe right. Brazil, all those places. And it was really hopping for a while.
Now, one of the things that's so fascinating about this book is that you've chosen 50 poems from 50 years of writing about New Orleans.
Right.
50 years! James Nolan!
I know. It doesn't seem that long, but it has been. And I have a poem about the assassination of Martin Luther King,
right,
which I wrote the week after he was assassinated. I was living in New Orleans. I didn't want to be at that time because there are four poems about my parents when they committed me to St. Vincent de Paul.
That was 1968.
And that was 1968, the year that rocked the world. I write at length about this in Flight Risk. And I think it's interesting to compare the poetic versions to the narrative versions.
Mm-hmm, of course. Let's hear one of the other fabulous poems, Over the Oysters.
Yeah, and this is for another older Bohemian friend of mine, Lee Grew.
A fixture of our poetry
scene, yes. And even before the kind of the Renaissance in the 90s and early 21st century, when we were starting all these clubs, these poetry performances, Lee has had a poetry theater in her backyard, and she had the Poetry Forum. This was all during the 70s and 80s. So she's really done a lot to keep poetry alive in New Orleans.
Absolutely.
And this is a story she told me, and it's about eating oysters with a friend of hers. It's called Over the Oysters. Bobby Blue Bland wipes beads of sweat from his brow with a big blue handkerchief, then drapes it over the mic, while back in a far corner, We have burst out crying. Birth, death, marriage, divorce, failure, success, money, sex. Waiters tilting to us, tray after tray of half shells, and pitcher after pitcher of Dixie beer, because here in New Orleans, feelings are cheap and raw and open, and we eat them by the dozen, weeping like the walrus and the carpenter over life, because we are living it. Weeping over the oysters as one by one we swallow them. The sea finally paying attention, its own tears arranged in a circle, each broken as a secret locket. And smiling slowly we drown as Bobby Blueblan mops his face, stares straight into the spotlight, and belts out one more song.
I love that. One more song.
Oh. One more song.
One more poem, James Nolan.
One more poem, one more book.
We've been talking with James Nolan about his new poetry collection, new and old, Nasty Water, Collected New Orleans Poems. James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's always a pleasure to be here.
I pity the fool. I said, I pity the fool. Well, I pity the fool, yeah. I said, I pity the fool.
United States Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith will be in Louisiana this week for two very special appearances. First, she'll be speaking Friday, December 14th from 6 to 8 at the Jean Lafitte Wetlands Acadian Cultural Center, 314 St. Mary Street in Thibodeau, with reception at 6, reading at 7. And then she'll appear again Saturday, December 15th from 10 to 11 at the South Lafourche Branch Library, 16241 East Main Street in Cutoff. This is part of her American Conversations, Celebrating Poems in Rural Communities series, in which Smith is traveling to rural communities and giving away copies of the anthology American Journal, 50 Poems for Our Time, which she will use to spark conversations about the power of poetry. American Journal is a beautiful anthology divided into five sections: The Small Town of My Youth, Something Shines Out from Every Darkness, Words Tangled in Debris, Here the Sentence Will Be Respected, and One Singing Thing. Yona Harvey's terrific Katrina poem, Hurricane, appears in the last section of the book. The poems touch on many aspects of American life, and New Orleans poet Jericho Brown represents New Orleans well with Nem in this section, as in Your Mama and Nem. Here it is. Nem. They said to say goodnight, but not goodbye. Unplugged the TV when it rained. They hid money in mattresses so to sleep on decisions. Some of their children were not their children. Some of their parents had no birth dates. They could sweat a cold out of you. They'd wake without an alarm telling them to. Even the short ones reached certain shelves. Even the skinny cooked animals too quick to catch. And I don't care how ugly one of them arrived. That one got married to somebody fine. They fed families with change and wiped their kitchens clean. Then another century came. People like me forgot their names. Every reader will find something to connect with in these poems, whether it's a sense of loss or celebration or fear or change or even anger. Poetry is life, after all, rendered through that most intimate of human voices. Tracy Smith's selections are purely wonderful. And don't miss her new collection, Wade in the Water, which takes its title from that great spiritual. This is a masterpiece. Smith trains her searching intelligence on a variety of issues, race, pollution, immigration, climate change, and it all comes together in a glorious panorama of past and present. One poem will strike close to home, Unrest in Baton Rouge, inspired by Jonathan Bachman's photograph of a young protester facing off riot police in the protests that occurred after the death of Alton Sterling in 2016. Here it is. Unrest in Baton Rouge, after the photo by Jonathan Bachman. Our bodies run with ink dark blood, blood pools in the pavement seams. Is it strange to say love is a language few practice, but all or near all speak? Even the men in black armor, the ones jangling handcuffs and keys, What else are they so buffered against if not love's blade, sizing up the heart's familiar meat? We watch and grieve. We sleep, stir, eat. Love. The heart sliced open, gutted, clean. Love. Naked almost in the everlasting street, skirt lifted by a different kind of breeze. An erasure poem, created by taking out words from the Declaration of Independence, is a showstopper in Weight of the Water, as are her poems created from narratives of African Americans who were enlisted in the Civil War. Wade in the Water is a book to ponder and to treasure. Keep it close, read it often. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here are the events for New Orleans. The Preservation Resource Center Holiday Gift Market takes place at Trinity Episcopal Church, 1329 Jackson Avenue, this weekend. On Sunday, December 9th, Alexis Breaux signs Bayou Ballet from 9:30 to 10:30. Brian Batt and Katie Dano sign Pontchartrain Beach, A Family Affair. And Emma Fick signs Snippets of New Orleans from 11:30 to 12:30. Brian Batt and Katie Dano sign Pontchartrain Beach, A Family Affair. Again, Tuesday, December 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Elsie Mathurnd signs her new young adult novel, Mystery School. Wednesday, December 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club hosts a potluck dinner and a discussion of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction winner Less by Andrew Sean Greer. That's Wednesday, December 12th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Bloodjet Poetry Series presents fiction with Colleen Rothman and Eric Paul. Wednesday, December 12th at 7:30 at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Here are the events in Baton Rouge. Mary Manheim signs the most recent in her Claire Carter Bone Detective series for young adults. Saturday, December 15th at 2 at Barnes & Noble City Place. Jeffrey Marks signs Walking with Tigers. Saturday, December 15th at 2 at Barnes & Noble City Place. And in St. Francisville, Alexis Breaux signs her children's books Sunday, December 9th from 9 to 5 at Parker Park at Christmas in the Country in St. Francisville. And don't miss poet laureate Tracy K. Smith's visit to Thibodeau and Cutoff. Tracy K. Smith discusses American Journal, 50 Poems for Our Time, Friday, December 14th from 6 to 8 at the Jean Lafitte Wetlands Acadian Cultural Center, 314 St. Mary Street in Thibodeau, reception at 6, reading at 7. Smith also appears Saturday, December 15th from 10 to 11 at the South Lafourche Branch Library, 16241 East Main Street in Cutoff, Louisiana. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Helles Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Helles Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.